Let's see. Was there anything else? Yes. You've turned to the book of Psalms. But before we go any further into the book of Psalms, I had been asked for the opportunity for somebody to share something from their life. And so I'm going to ask Joy to come on up. Maybe I should just come to you. You're good. Okay. It's Kelly's mic. We'll call.
There we go.
We'll call Joy Kelly or Kelly Joy or something like that. Do you need a stool or anything? Or it's not going to be that long.
Okay. Yeah. No. You guys, for the last 4 weeks, have watched me sit in the back with a wheelchair. Most of you know, some of you don't, that about 4 weeks ago, I suffered what some of the doctors call catastrophic knee injury. Gail, if I say anything that's incorrect to you, or Jenny, please step up and correct me on what I'm saying. Gail was with me the first two times we were picking blackberries when I suffered the injury, and the doctor, when we first did it, thought that it was mostly just a torn ACL. But she said, stay around. I just want the radiologist to look at their x-rays too. And so we did. And she comes back in and she says, you had such a big fracture going into your knee. I don't know how I missed it. And she said, I'm glad you stayed here. And things kind of went downhill from there real quick. And she was telling me the severity of the injury. And as an ER nurse, I already knew. With the words, when they said tibial plateau fracture, I knew right then what it meant. I also knew that when they picked up my leg in x-ray, I told Jeff, the x-ray tech, I said, Jeff, I can't pick up my leg. And so he grabs it around the ankle, and as he puts it up on the table, my knee kind of goes backwards like that. And I'm like, after I scream, I said, that's not a good thing. So the doctor was very honest. She said, you know, Joy, that with this fracture, there's about a 90-95% chance that you've torn out your ACL too. I said, yeah. And she said, plus it's unstable. So that is that much more of an indication. They did an emergency CAT scan. They were thinking I was going to need surgery early the next morning. Called me back, said, your knee's stable enough. You don't need surgery tomorrow, but you've got to get in. So we get into the orthopedist. He looks at the knee and he says, you know, with what I see on the x-ray, I'm not even going to try your ligaments right now. That's inconsequential until we see what happens with your bones. And so he starts to lift up my leg for the other guy to put the brace on. And he says, oh, that's floppy. You never as a patient, even as a nurse, want to hear, oh, that's floppy. And so from there, he starts laying out the plans. And he says to me, he says, you'll come back in 4 weeks. In 6 weeks, we will start physical therapy, but it will be for bending and bending only. He said, you're not to put any pressure on this knee for 12 weeks. And so I said, okay. And I said, well, you know, the amazing part of the whole thing is from the very beginning, God gave me such a peace with this. Hearing what I've heard about my knee and knowing I'm going to be off 12 weeks, I'm like, that's going to be a long time, God. And so he's teaching me a lot of things. And one of the biggest things is he gave me such an incredible peace. For the first time in my life, I think, I honestly knew what that peace that passes all understanding. It's one I couldn't say what it was. And people would say, oh, man, you've had such a rough year. You lost Vic. And 3 months later, you blow out your knee with this kind of an injury. And I'm like, guys, I'm good with it. I'm really good with it. It's okay. He took the pain. I had no pain. I had three doctors more than willing to give me pain meds. And it's like, so I told the orthopedist, I said, well, if you want to give me just a few to get me through just in case the weekend, and all. And he's like, oh, I'm going to give you more than a few. And he said to me, he says, and if you don't use them, save them because you're going to need them for therapy. I said, okay, that's good enough. Well, Jen and I go back last Wednesday, and it's almost embarrassing to say that my faith is so weak. But all the way down there, I'm sitting there putting dates of soccer games into my calendar because when we get in there, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm telling this guy, we're getting the surgery. We're repairing my ACL so I can get started on rehab. It's time to go. And so they do the x-rays. I get back over in the room. They put the x-rays up on the computer for the doctor to see. And he goes in and he kind of looks at the x-rays a minute. And Jennifer's like, wait a minute. I've been waiting on you hand and foot now and bringing you meals and doing all this stuff. And I don't see much on that x-ray. And so the guy looks at the x-ray and then he comes over and he starts looking at me and I'm in a wheelchair with the brace off and he starts to kind of put my knee and he starts to bend it and he's looking up at me every time he bends it a little bit. And he's like, well, when are you going to call uncle here? You're not supposed to be able to bend like this. And I never did. He was able to bend it the whole way without any pain. And so he starts checking the ligaments and he's like, this knee is stable. I said, Caden, do you remember what you said 4 weeks ago? You called my knee floppy. And so he goes back over and he looks up at that x-ray again and he says, the only thing that I can even see on this x-ray to even suggest a fracture is the calcium where it's healed. And so the next thing out of his mouth is, he says, you know, Joy, he said, these are those miracle working magical hands. And he said, I specialize in these. And I had to look up at him and say, Caden, man, I'm sorry, but I really hate to bust your bubble. But it wasn't you. I serve a God that twice in this place, our church has prayed for me. The last time, ever since I was hurt, Jeremiah, you back there? Come here. The first time when Larry called for the church to gather around and pray by me, this little guy right here, every time I rolled into the place, he stayed right at my side and did everything I wanted. And he waited patiently as all the adults prayed. And then when they thought everything was over, here comes this little still small voice saying, oh God, help Joy's leg. Heal Joy's leg. And he did, baby. He healed it. I love you. Last week, Terry again called for prayer. We prayed for Salem. We prayed for me. I was telling the guys then, again, the lack of faith. I wasn't even thinking in the terms of healing. I was so comfortable with where I was with what God was teaching me through the thing that I told the girls, okay, my knee's good. You don't worry about praying for my knee. I'm good with my knee, but I really need some patience right now to behave and do what they're telling me to do. And so Caden, after he looked at the knee, things and went, wow, he says, Wednesday, he says, you can start putting 50% weight on your leg. Next week, you walk at 100% and lose your walker whenever you feel comfortable with it. And your brace, when you feel stable enough, you can lose your brace too. And Jennifer says, well, she's been kind of biting at the bits to go to therapy. What about therapy? And he looks at it and he says, she's doing so well. She doesn't even need therapy.
Mm. So when Joy wanted to share, actually it was yesterday, we were just kind of confirming that she was going to share and stuff. And she goes, you know, I'm a little hesitant. And I said, I'll bet you I know why you're hesitant. And we talked about it, because the reality is God doesn't always answer that way. And I looked at her and I said, you know, here's the thing though. We don't not testify to the work and the power of God because he hasn't worked that way in all of us. We celebrate it. And at the same time, we're sensitive to, and we recognize that that's not always God's plan. We prayed how long and how much that Vicky would be healed. Right? And she was, ultimately, right? But in the sense of earthly physical healings, which Jesus does, she wasn't. And yet in this particular case, we don't know why. We don't know why, but we celebrate the work that God does as God does it in the way that he wants to do it. Which is why I think it's even incredibly perfect timing that God takes us through Psalm 23. Because it's in that context that I think we walk into this. So turn to Psalm 23 with me. Many of us are probably able to say this from memory, but since we'll end up with 257 different varieties, we'll read it out of the ESV. Psalm 23, a psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen. Be seated. So we're going to take this fall, and in a similar fashion as Prayer Summit, we are going to break up Psalm 23, and that is going to take us to Advent. The fall is kind of broken up. Next week, we do have service in the evening. Did anybody look at the time? It's in your bulletin. See, you haven't even looked at your bulletin. See, that's I'm telling you. I told you to look at your bulletin. What time? 6 o'clock. Next Sunday evening, 6 o'clock, we are going to have service, and we have a special guest speaking, sharing God's word, Pastor Ken LeMay, Senior. So we've got that going on. We've got a joint service at the end of the month, and we've got just things that break it up. And so I know you're kind of like, really, Psalm 23, the entire fall? How is that going to work? We'll keep. We can do it. Can we be done by the end of fall, though? That's going to become the question, right? Psalm 23. Spurgeon calls this the pearl of the Psalms. He calls it the pearl of the Psalms. Henry Ward Beecher called it the nightingale of the Psalms. Psalm 23, probably one of these Psalms that we have heard our entire life before we even knew Christ. We'd probably go to a funeral and hear Psalm 23 spoken or recited. The interesting thing is that we most often hear it in funerals, and actually funerals are probably the furthest thing from the implications of Psalm 23. And so I want to just give us a little bit of background, context, information this morning. And to help me do that, I'm going to invite the kids up. So I'm going to ask the kids to go ahead and... hold up. You haven't listened to the rest of it. I'm going to ask us to sit in the front row here. Okay? Because you're actually going to help me right now with my sermon. I'm not preaching it all by myself. So you have to help me, okay? Anybody else coming up? Okay. All right. Now, let's start with you guys. Have you heard of Psalm 23?
Yes.
Yes?
I have.
You don't remember much of it at all. Well, guess what? You're going to have a couple of months to learn a lot about it. Anybody have an idea who wrote Psalm 23? David. You thought so. Well, you thought right, Knuckles. You thought right. Excellent. So, and you called it out, so I'll give you Knuckles too. Okay. Finger, knuckle, just because you want Knuckles. So, no. What do you guys know about David?
That he was a king.
That he was a king. A king of?
Israel.
He was a very good king. He was a very good king. He's not like other kings. That's right. He was a very good king. He had more friends than enemies? He mourned for his friends and enemies. Yes. Yep. We're actually going to talk a little bit about that this morning. What else do you know about King David? He wrote a lot of psalms, a lot of songs, right? Saul chased him all over the place trying to kill him. Excellent. What else do you guys know about David? There's a really famous story. What? He was a shepherd. Yep.
He slew Goliath.
Excellent. Oh, slain. Oh, okay. Grammatic correction here. Attempted grammatic correction. Okay, what else? So Goliath, yeah, that took place. What else do you know about David? Yes. Let's not skirt the issues at all. Let's just get right into it, right? Yes. Us adults would say he had relationships with Bathsheba. Right? Because we're afraid of saying that three-letter word. So, yes. And what was the result of the baby?
The first baby died.
Did Bathsheba have any more babies from David?
Yes.
Do you know who?
Solomon.
Absolutely. Excellent. We got some good.
Absalom tried to kill him.
Oh, you're right. We're going to talk about that too. Boy, you guys know a lot about David. So I wanted to quiz you and find out. So as we keep going this morning, if you remember some of these stories, I want you to yell them out. Okay. But thank you for helping me to establish where we're going to go with Psalm 23. Okay? You guys can go back to the back and I don't know, do something. Don't do what David did. I don't think we have anybody named Bathsheba, so we're all set. David. When does David enter into the story? The big story that we have called Scripture. When does David enter into the story? No. Let's turn. When Samuel comes to anoint the new king, why? The favor has left Saul. In fact, we find that the Spirit of God has left Saul as the king, right? Anybody know where we find this at? There's two Samuels. So which Samuel? First Samuel. Excellent. So if you want to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16, we're not going to sit and read a whole bunch. We're just going to kind of go through and outline David's life. And I welcome you along the journey to interject observations that you know and that you have about this. So in 1 Samuel chapter 16, yes, David gets anointed as king. And what do we find out about David at this point in time? He's a shepherd, okay? Because when Samuel comes to anoint, he's not with the family because he is out taking care of the flocks, right? Okay, so he's a shepherd. What else do we find out about him? He's the youngest, probably, okay? What else? Not a whole lot of physical stature to him, but he's handsome. Okay. is man after God's own heart. Yes, we know that as we go along. Absolutely. Do we learn anything else? He might have some jealous brothers. Thank you. In fact, I'm gonna throw out something that is kind of borderline. Okay. See, Christina says it's true. I'm gonna say it's borderline. That's gonna step on some people's toes. It is possible that David was illegitimate. And there's actually scripture to talk about. I'm not saying he was or wasn't, but part of the jealousy may have been from the relationship that was involved in the family. Mixes in some of the dynamics. But regardless of whether you want to dive in there or not, you can look into that on your own another time. So we see young David. Samuel comes. He calls everybody before him. He's like, where's the last child? This is all that you have. And they're like, well, no, actually, we got one more, right? He's out in the fields. They call him in. Samuel anoints him. And immediately what begins to happen? The irony of this, because David is anointed by Samuel. And if you look about halfway through chapter 16, right now, verse 14, now the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him. And Saul's servant said to him, behold, now harmful spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is skillful in playing. So what's going to take place here? We know the story. What's going to take place? They find David. And so David enters the service of Saul. We come to chapter 17, the infamous story of David and Goliath. We move on to chapter 18 of 1 Samuel, and we begin to see this deep, intimate friendship that David has with Jonathan. Anybody see the problem developing here? Saul's not liking David any longer. It's starting to grow. He's friends with Jonathan, and so this whole relationship is not going as hoped, probably, by Saul. So, to help remedy that. David marries Saul's daughter. So then we come to chapter 19, which is Saul trying to kill David. Jonathan doesn't believe it, right? At first, chapter 20, Jonathan doesn't really believe that. He says, let me do a little bit of investigating. He investigates, and what does he find out? His dad wants to kill him. So David begins this long journey of running and hiding for his life. Hiding out in caves, hiding out in, if you would, unholy populations, right? Just to preserve his own life. And in this process of running and hiding, what does he develop? A group of merry men. Okay, he's not quite Robin Hood, but you know, he gets this group of merry men, group of people that are committed to David. In fact, they want to take Saul out so that David could go to his rightful place, right? On the throne. David has to control the masses at this point in time and say, no, 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 it is not my will. We learn a huge lesson from the life of David here. David says, it is God's will and God's timing, not mine. That's a tough one for some of us to swallow, is it not? Some of us were like, we know what God's will is, and we want to make it happen now. We know what God's will is, and because we've been raised in the microwave culture, we believe that we should have instant gratification, and so if it's God's will, it must be God's will now. And David sets for us this example to say, no, no, no. It's God's will, and it's God's time. So we continue moving through chapter 22. He's in the cave. Chapter 23 does some great work. Chapter 24, he spares Saul's life. Don't you wish the Bible actually read that fast, right? Chapter 25, Samuel dies. So we no longer have this intermediary, right, that can help with the situation. You got David and Abigail. Surprised that Jonathan didn't say anything about her. David spares Saul again, chapter 27. He flees to the Philistines. Hey, remember that story about Saul in the medium? Oh, yeah. That's a good one. That's in chapter 28. You can read that sometime. David's rejected by the Philistines. That's gotta hurt, right? Chapter 30, David's wives are captured. That's the title. That's really interesting. Chapter 31, the death of Saul. We go into 2 Samuel. Bet you've never had a pastor go through so many books so quickly in the Bible, right? What's that? Not this one. 2 Samuel, chapter 2, he finally takes his rightful place on the throne, right? He moves into the house. He's the dude now. Chapter 11, we have the story that Jonathan so graciously referred to. Chapter 12, we have the rebuke from Nathan. From there, we begin to move into the conflict that's within the household, right? We begin to see the issues of power, vying for power, rise up. If we fast forward to 1 Kings 1, we see that Solomon is anointed king. 1 Kings chapter 2, David dies. There's the life of David in a nutshell. Obviously, there's a lot that we didn't cover. Most of us are generally aware of David's life. Many of us probably even know specific things within David's life. But the question comes, when was Psalm 23 written? If it was written by David, it was written at some point in time in his life. Now, there are keys in the process that help us to understand, and we're going to talk a little bit about those, but there are two primarily considered places that David wrote Psalm 23. Two primary locations. Again, there's a plethora of opinions and thoughts out there, but the majority narrow down to one of two places. The first place that people often consider is 1 Samuel chapter 30. Look there with me. Again, we're not going to spend a lot of time in it, but 1 Samuel chapter 30. Remember I said in chapter 29, if you look at your titles, the Philistines reject David. If you recall the story at all, David is living among the Philistines. The Philistines are going out to battle. David offers himself and his men to the service of the Philistines in this battle. So they go out with him, and the Philistine leadership decides, no, 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 we don't trust you enough. So David is sent back. And when David arrives, guess what happens? Everybody's gone. Not only his wives are gone, but all the wives, all the children, everybody from the camp are all gone. It's possible that David wrote Psalm 23 in this context. I'm not convinced of it. I know we're borderlining on theology and opinion right here. That's okay. You can think that David wrote it here. I'm not convinced of it, and I'm going to show you why. So the second place that we strongly consider is 2 Samuel chapter 16 through 18. By the time we come to 2 Samuel chapter 16, all of the power struggles within his family have begun to surface. In fact, at this point in time, David has been driven out of Jerusalem. Out of his throne, he's on the run. And we pick it up kind of in chapter 16. You recognize the story? Excellent. Good. You help me fix it if it's wrong, okay? So David's leaving and he gets cursed up and down by a guy, right? If you're looking at chapter 16, he gets cursed up and down. While that's taking place, Absalom, David's son, enters into Jerusalem to take the throne. You move to chapter 17 and we see that there's some saving work that goes on. And we see now that there's this internal struggle for David. I know what God has called me to do, and that is to reign as king. But I have this problem because I dearly love my son. And I don't want to see him die. As a matter of fact, that is the internal struggle of David. And it becomes a struggle within the leadership team that he has composed. the leadership team is telling David, look, he has to die for you to sit on the throne. And he's like, do everything you can to save young Absalom so that we can try to restore all of this and put things back into the proper place. At this moment in time, David is at Mahanaim. His counselors have gathered around him. David is grief-stricken and heartbroken over this entire thing. Now, it's fun if you go back and you watch how David and Absalom related and the issues that could be there. And I'm sure therapists love to focus in on that, to talk about father-son relationships. And we're not doing that this morning. We're just acknowledging that David was in a very broken place at this moment in time. Oh, just yesterday you read the story. Awesome. So he is broken. We see the depth of his love for Absalom in 2 Samuel chapter 18, if you look there, beginning right near the end at verse 31. David at this point in time has heard of Absalom's death. Verse 31, and behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, good news for my lord the king. Would not want to be this guy. For the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you. The king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. As the story goes on, we see that some of his leadership comes to him and says, David, you've got to resolve this in yourself right now. You've got to figure this out because the people are looking to you to lead them. And you are mourning over the very person that sought to kill you. Jonathan and Jeremiah had already indicated, I think it was Jeremiah, right? David mourned over his enemy. He mourned over the loss of his enemies, his son included in that process. And so here's David in a very broken place. And so there's a lot that tend to believe it may have been here that David wrote Psalm 23. And why here? Well, when we begin to look through Psalm 23, we find that infamous first phrase, right? The Lord is my shepherd. And we might think that David is reflecting back to his youth as a shepherd, and he probably was. But it was regularly understood that that word shepherd meant king. That kings of that time were referred to as shepherds. So it couldn't have been that early in David's life because he needed to understand kingship. So when he calls out, the Lord is my shepherd, he's referring both to his past as well as to his present in kingship. When we look at the words that say, I shall not want, he'll lead me beside still or quiet waters, David would have had to know the distinction of peace. And since he warred a lot of his life, it may not have been until later that he understood peace. Paths of righteousness. Well, how would David know that the shepherd leads in paths of righteousness? Jonathan! How would David know that the shepherd, that is God, leads in paths of righteousness? How would David know that God, as the good shepherd, would lead him down paths of righteousness? How did he see God lead him in paths of righteousness? When did God do it before in his life? Okay, those aren't the ones that I'm thinking of. You mentioned it earlier, though. Because after he commits adultery, God pursues David. See, we got to wrestle with this because, again, what we often think of God and sin, David commits adultery and God pursues David. How did God lead David down paths of righteousness? What? Okay, taking his son. But even prior to that, in the same story, what happens? How does God pursue David? Who? Nathan. God sends Nathan to go have this conversation with David. How many of us would have volunteered to go talk to David about his adultery? No, but see, God loves us so much that he would find people who he will send to confront us. He leads us down paths of righteousness. You know, David had the ability at that moment in time when Nathan came to sit there and go, get lost. Great story, Nathan. I know what you're trying to do. Get lost. David doesn't do that. David hears from Nathan. He hears the story. He realizes his eyes are open because God leads him down paths of righteousness. Why does God lead him down paths of righteousness? For his namesake. God goes, you are the king of my people. So when we look at the writing of this, it's probably after the whole thing with Bathsheba. The valley of the shadow of death. Well, it could have been while he was hiding from Saul. But Bathsheba hadn't happened. So when we start to piece these things together, it's likely that valley of the shadow of death, when was he most distraught? Absalom. When Absalom was coming after him. Your rod and your staff. Correction and protection. Right? I don't look forward to talking about that one. Your rod and your staff, the correction and the protection. You prepare a table in the presence of my enemies. Early in David's life, he didn't know enemies. But as he became king, he took on the enemies of the nation. He becomes that representative, so he had lots of enemies. And he got to see the work of God actually prepare the table in the presence of his enemies. And then he says, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. There had to have been a key moment in David's life for him to coin, to pen that phrase, to dwell in the house of the Lord. And I think he was reflecting back now to 2 Samuel chapter 7 when God covenants with David. What was David's heart desire that didn't get fulfilled in his time? To build the temple. He longed to build a house for God. And God goes, David, your hands are too bloody. But your son will build it for me. So how the heart of David must have thought on that for the years ahead to go, oh, I long to dwell in that house. To dwell in the presence of God. It is significant, I think, for us to realize that David writes this, Psalm 23, most likely writes it in the depths of his sorrow and anguish and a whole bunch of other emotional turmoil that is in his life. The son he loves has rebelled against him. He's caused civil war and he's gunning for David. He has seen his family rise and now become destroyed over power struggles. That never happens today in our families, does it? I think this is important to understand because we can all at times in our lives place ourselves into the life of David. Or David's life into ours. We can all associate. I mean, I'm not saying we all have Absalom and that our son is trying to, you know, take over and kill us and all that kind of stuff. But we know the struggles that David faced. We can resonate in our soul with the emotional turmoil that he's going through, the heartbrokenness, the distraught nature that he's encountering in this process. And so I think it's important for us to come into Psalm 23 understanding where David was when he pens these words. David was likely not on the high, lofty mountaintop going, God is so awesome. Woohoo! We're just saying great praise music. And you know what? He's my shepherd. And because he's my shepherd, I shall not want. No. There's a lot of reason to believe that David was in the throes of agony, deep dark place in his life. Dare I say, asking the question of Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? You called me to be king, and now this is what I have to go through. We've all been there. And if we can't remember a time, trust me, we will likely be there again at some point. And it's important to understand we can relate to David. Second component I want to tackle really quick is the importance of the placement of the psalm. The importance of the placement of this psalm is significant. It is sandwiched, believe it or not, we have a numerical system, right? And it's sandwiched between... Okay, let's backtrack for a second. What psalm are we talking about? Psalm 23. And so Psalm 23, believe it or not, is sandwiched between 22 and 24. Has anybody ever looked to connect them together? 22 is another really famous one. It's a really hugely famous one because of Jesus. And it begins in 22 verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so what we find is there's this sandwich here, Psalm 22, 23, and 24. And I just want to take us through, this is, I'll be honest, I stole this material from somebody else. It's that good. It is. Because I think it helps to put, again, some more context into the process. So in Psalm 22, what we find is the Good Shepherd crucified. John, Gospel John, Jesus says, I am the Good Shepherd. If you read through Psalm 22, what you will find out is it is all about Jesus. One of these days I'm going to preach Psalm 22 because it's that first verse is so misunderstood. Some of you have heard me talk a little bit about it, but that first verse is so misunderstood and has been ripped out of context and has been abused and misused in the church for decades, centuries, millennia. Anyways, so in Psalm 22, we find the Good Shepherd is crucified. In Psalm 23, we find the Great Shepherd caring. And in Psalm 24, what we find is this beautifully triumphant song about the return of Christ. So it's the Chief Shepherd coming. So you have Good Shepherd crucified, Great Shepherd caring, Chief Shepherd coming. Spurgeon has said that when the phrase, my God, why have you forsaken me, is spoken in Psalm chapter 22, verse 1, it is almost necessary to see and to encounter that before we can say, the Lord is my shepherd. We must experience the value of blood shedding and of the sword being awakened against the shepherd before we can truly know the sweetness of the Good Shepherd's care. It's necessary for it to be couched here in this because we need to understand Christ crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me, before we can ever understand the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. And dare I say that continues on, that in order for us to really appreciate and understand the return of Christ, the coming King, we need to understand and believe and experience the Lord as our shepherd. See, I think currently in our day and age, in our lives, that's where we struggle. We kind of sit there and we go, yeah, Christ is coming back. But because we haven't encountered him well enough that he is our shepherd, we're sitting there going, it'll be great because all this other stuff will be done. But we miss the personal encounter of what's going to happen when he returns. Does that make sense? So just like we can't, as Spurgeon says, it's difficult for us to understand the Lord is our shepherd if we don't understand the pain and the agony of the cross. It's hard for us to really appreciate the return of God to this world if we haven't understood his present caring for us. Good Shepherd crucified, Great Shepherd caring, Chief Shepherd coming. What we see in chapter 22 is the shepherd's cross. What we see in 23 is the shepherd's crook. And what we see in 24 is the shepherd's crown. What we find in chapter 22 is the shepherd's grace. What we see in chapter 23 is the shepherd's guidance. And what we see in chapter 24 is the shepherd's glory. What we see in chapter 22 is the substitute for us. He died for us yesterday. In 23, we see the shepherd who is caring today. And in 24, we see the king who is sovereign forever. Hebrews tells us Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And he proved it in the Old Testament and he declares it again in the New Testament. What we find is the perfect placement between the cross and the return, the acknowledgement of the Good Shepherd. We find that pain, that feeling forsaken by God, leads us toward the heart of the shepherd, which in turn leads us in greater confidence to the fullness of God's kingdom. So I couldn't go without a question. Here's the question this morning. Where do I find my life right now? Where do I find my life situation right now? Do I find myself experiencing Psalm 22, 23, or 24? Have I really grabbed hold of an experience and a knowledge of the suffering servant, Jesus Christ? Because if I have, then I know that I can trust him as my shepherd. Have I encountered and known and experienced the good shepherd of Jesus Christ who suffered and died for me so that I can appreciate the sovereignty that he has now and forever? In what ways do I resonate with each of the Psalms? None of them are super long Psalms. I encourage you this week to take and read through Psalm 22, 23, and 24, maybe even over and over and over again, to understand the flow that actually takes place there, not just the isolation of the Psalms. Where do I find myself feeling forsaken by God right now? You know, we had this incredible testimony of miraculous healing. Somebody that was going to be stuck in bed or relative bed and then surgery and then stuck in bed. And what she needed to be praying for was patience for Jennifer and I. And then you turn around and you go and you see the doctor and he goes, I see that something happened there, but I don't know what. And I'm not asking this a hypothetical question. I don't want you to give me an answer. Hypothetical, that's not the word that I was looking for. Rhetorical, thank you. I'm sleep deprived from soccer. That's my excuse. Rhetorical question. How many of us, when we heard that testimony this morning, our hearts sank because we said, God hasn't answered my prayer like that. It's okay. I mean, that's life. It happens. Do we feel forsaken by God right now? Because we don't have that same experience going on. Where do I find myself struggling with the goodness of the shepherd? Oh, I believe in Jesus and I've had that encounter, that experience. I know he died for my sins. I know that he was crushed on the cross. He bore the weight of all the sin of all eternity there. And I understand what Christ did for me. But you know, I haven't always seen the goodness of the shepherd. Haven't always seen that in my life. Maybe some of us are in Psalm 24. And I ask, where have I encountered the goodness of the shepherd and now can more boldly proclaim his sovereignty as king? Because when we really understand the goodness of the shepherd, we don't wrestle with his sovereignty. When we can embrace and we can truly say, as David says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green or quiet or green pastures. He leads me beside still or quiet waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Incredible imagery there. I walk through the valley of the shadow. Most of us have read that and gone, yeah, Jesus will take us through the valley of death. No, no, no. We're talking about the shadow. I don't know that any of us know the fullness of pain of the valley of death. Because God takes us through the valley of the shadow of death. So I'll fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me, you prepare a table. You know, when that becomes reality in our life, we don't sit around going, well, I don't know if that was really God's will. We go, God is sovereign. And that situation that I just stepped into because I messed up and I blew it, I know that He leads me in paths of righteousness, so He's going to use that mistake to glorify Himself and to restore me. And we become okay with that because we become okay with His sovereignty. Psalm 23 is not a funeral dirge, though that's where we often associate it. Psalm 23 is a reminder of life renewed by the shepherd. It leads us to a greater understanding and appreciation of the shepherd's sovereignty. It reminds us that life is not easy, but it doesn't change the character of God. Life is not easy. But just because our life is not easy doesn't change who God is. And that's the place of Psalm 23 for us. It's to reflect once again on who is this shepherd. He declared Himself the good shepherd in John. So maybe we should find out what the shepherd does. Maybe we should find out what the shepherd is striving to do in our own lives, in the midst of whatever emotional state that we're in right now. Because I love the fact that the psalm sits there and goes, look, when you're down, remember, the good shepherd leads you besides quiet and still waters. He feeds you. He restores you. He nourishes you. So when you're down, remember that God has a place for you to grow strong again. But I love the fact that in the same psalm, when you're high, when you're like, dude, Jesus rocks and, you know, we're going to party all the time. And he goes, by the way, I also walk you through the valley of the shadow of death. Enjoy the quiet waters right now. Enjoy the green grass because we've got a journey ahead for us. So God takes these extremes and he brings them into tension and into balance to say, I'm there all the time. Leading you and guiding you and directing you. And so I don't know. I look forward to the rest of this fall diving into this and going, who is this shepherd? And what does he want for us? Not just what does he want from us, but what does he want for us in the process of being the good shepherd? Father, would you help us to see and understand the greatness of who you are. The greatness of your presence with us. The greatness of the joys and the greatness of the struggles. The greatness of heartbreak. The greatness of miracles to be celebrated. Father, this week, would you invite us to spend time in your word and enable us, allow us to see how the cross leads to life. And how your life leads us to the celebration of the coming King. It's not just about something in the past. It's not just about how we're living our life right now, but it is also about the future and what the future holds. So Father, would you remind us where we are right now with you? And would you cause us with excitement and anticipation to look ahead to where you want to take us?